You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 104, covering the week of January 15th through January 19th, 2018. Glad to be back on the program. Glad to be here. Before we get started, just want to remind you of all the usual things. If you like this podcast, you can share it around on social media, and you can find us on social media on Twitter at Abbeville INST, on Facebook at Abbeville Institute, and of course, you can subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville INST. If you want to, go to our website. You can give us an email address, and we'll give you a free ebook, Kirkpatrick Sales, Emancipation Hell. You can also help us explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition through our webpage as well, where you can go to abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll see a button that says support. You click on that, and you'll see memberships for individuals for as little as $3 a month or $5 a month. $3 a month if you're a student, $5 a month if you're not a student. You can help us in our mission to explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. You can also give annually $25 a month if you're a student or $25 a year if you're a student or $50 a year if you're not a student. We have other options as well. So just go on out there and check out our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. And if you do give us an email address, you'll get our daily dose of Dixie along with our week in review email on Saturday or Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast. Also, if you want to review this podcast at iTunes, you can do that as well. The more reviews, the better. And the better reviews, the better it is. So going out to iTunes as well, you can leave a review of this podcast. And I just want to remind you that we do have a conference coming up February 24th in Charleston, South Carolina. It's on Confederate monuments and what the attack on those monuments means for America today. Our keynote speaker is Ben Cooter Jones. So that's the Saturday night banquet. So you can go on out to our webpage. At the middle of the page, you'll see you're invited, and it has a link to the event. So go on out there and get your tickets now. We only have about a month left before the event. And also, if you're listening to this podcast before January 23rd, that is the last day to get your reduced rates for your hotel room. So go on out there and register now, get your hotel room, and we'd love to see you in Charleston. Okay, well, let's talk about the material for this particular week. We had a lot of good stuff. In fact, of course, this is Robert E. Lee's birthday week, and so we had a couple of pieces that relate to Lee and military history, and a couple of pieces that have to do with the current attack on Confederate monuments, because all of these things are wrapped in together. You know, there was a time that Lee was considered to be one of the greatest Americans in American history, and I remember when I was writing my Politically Incorrect Guide to Real American Heroes, which I included Lee and Jackson, whose birthday is, of course, on the 21st, and so we'll talk about Jackson next week. I remember there was a calendar in my house growing up from a Northern insurance company, and on this particular calendar from 1940, they actually listed Robert E. Lee's birthday as a holiday, as a great day for all Americans to celebrate. But that's changed, and I think that as a couple of pieces get into, that's part and parcel of the current cultural climate that we live in, and it comes down to things like political correctness or cultural Marxism. You can call it a variety of different things, but certainly Lee, who was recognized North and South by a number of individuals as a great American, as one American who was trying to heal the wounds of the war. I mean, here's a man who was very much interested in reconciliation. And that's the interesting part about the current attack on Confederate memorials. Most of these were erected during a period of reconciliation, a time when people were interested in burying the hatchet, so to speak, and putting down the sword and saying, you know what, we were all Americans. You fought for what you believed in, we fought for what we believed in, but let's put that aside and come back together, shake hands across the chasm, and we will repair the Union. There was essentially an unwritten deal that was cut. The South would recognize Lincoln as a great president. The North would recognize people like Lee and Jackson as great Americans, and they did. I mean, E.L. Godkin, who was certainly a Northern partisan, more of a libertarian, certainly a Northern partisan, recognized Stonewall Jackson as one of the greatest Americans who ever lived. And here was a guy who was vehemently in favor of the Union cause during the war, a very staunch Republican. But he recognized Stonewall Jackson as a great American. And the same thing can be said for Lee. There were very few people in the Reconciliationist period that thought Lee was anything but a great American. And so this first piece that we had for this week, entitled The Elite Versus the Deplorables by Gail Jarvis, gets into that. And he points out that, you know, a lot of times what we have, and he begins the piece talking about the situation with Roy Moore in Alabama and how this was really just a smokescreen in many ways for an agenda. Now, certainly, you know, in 2018, 2017, we can question what was happening with what Moore was doing, and question the moral justification for these things. But it's certainly clear, as Gail Jarvis noted, that once the election was over, all that stuff stopped. And so, if you look at the people that were promoting the anti-Moore campaign, and it began long before all those allegations were made, there was certainly a backlash against Roy Moore because he wasn't towing the establishment line. He never did. He never had been. And so that's the same thing with this attack on Confederate monuments. And he brings up, he says, look, these memorials are often disparagingly called Jim Crow era monuments, insinuating they were erected only to intimidate blacks and keep them subordinate to whites. But we must remember that so-called Jim Crow era lasted roughly a century, the end of Reconstruction to the Civil Rights Movement, Second Reconstruction, he says. During all those years, numerous monuments honoring Civil War heroes were erected in both the North and the South. Those honoring Confederate heroes have become vilified, while those honoring Union heroes have not. And this is true. I mean, this is something when you look at Confederate monuments, you have to understand this was a period of monument building, North and South. And even people like Booker T. Washington famously said, look, I think we need to erect monuments that show the best of Southern character. These great men of the South need to be recognized. And most of these monuments, though, when you look at where they went up, most of them are dedicated just to the common soldier. Very few are dedicated to actual individuals. You have, of course, some honoring Lee and Jackson and, of course, Forrest and a few others. But most of them, all around the South, and the thousands of monuments that are erected in the South, most of them are erected to the common soldier. And they simply have a simple obelisk or perhaps a soldier, just a no-name soldier on top of the monument. Of course, you know, so that's one part of this that people, and a lot of them are in cemeteries because that's where they're originally constructed. So you have a few that are in public places. But the other thing about that is that these monuments that are put in public places are paid for by private donations. They weren't usually erected by state money or even city money. This was money that was raised privately. And then, of course, some property was selected. And a city and a monument was erected. We have to remember the social and physical cost of the war, and we're going to get into that in the piece on Wednesday. The social and physical cost of this war was tremendous in the South, much more though so than in the North. And Southerners were quite fine with Northerners building monuments to their heroes, and Northerners, for the most part, were quite fine with Southerners building monuments to their heroes. It was all a part of healing the wounds of the war, and Lee represented that better than anyone else. And we'll talk about Lee in a few minutes. Jarvis says, quote, there is reluctance among those who currently in power to say anything commendable about the South's history. We never hear comments like these made by the late President John F. Kennedy. This is his quote, Kennedy's quote. Quote, the South is the land of Washington who made our nation, of Jefferson who shaped its direction, and of Robert E. Lee. After gallant failure, urge those who had followed him in bravery to reunite America in purpose and courage. This is John F. Kennedy. He also called John C. Calhoun one of the greatest senators in American history. You won't find that now. John F. Kennedy. I mean, really, in so many ways, the poster child of the early progressive left. Or the mid-century progressive left, to be better. So, and Kennedy was pictured many times with Confederate flags, speaking in front of them, receiving one as a gift. So I think it's really interesting that what's happened over time is after a period of years, after decades, when nothing else is there to attack, now statues and symbols come under attack because they have to keep the cultural Marxists, the political correct individuals, have to keep this thing in the news because it distracts from real issues. I mean, that's the case. I mean, you look at New Orleans and what happened there and the amount of money they spent to take down the Lee and Davis statues while their infrastructure is failing. They had terrible flooding in New Orleans because their drain systems are awful. The money they spent on these things could have helped improve those situations, but no. The crime rate in New Orleans is awful. And so you have real issues, but yet everyone's focusing on some statues, which in fact increased tourism. People have already said, well, look, we're not going to go down and go to New Orleans anymore. The crime is too high. So cleaning up the area and helping improve tourism would actually help boost the economy of New Orleans. But yet they're focused on taking down statues, which this is an issue that's in many ways a local issue. And unfortunately, in New Orleans and other places, people defend these statues are outvoted sometimes. Now, the issue in the situation in Memphis was much more dangerous, because what we had is a state law that said, look, you can't take these things down, and they bypassed that. The city council bypassed that and did it with a big smile on their face, saying, well, you know what we did? We sold that land to a private entity, and then they took them down. And of course, they sold it below market value, and there are questions now about how that transaction was carried out, whether it was above the board or whether it was illegal activity. There probably was there. And so eventually, this situation is going to be hashed out in court, and maybe those statues have to go back up, which would be absolutely hilarious, but for the Memphis City Council. But the fact is, people are trying to put laws in place to keep this thing from happening. But really what's at stake here is the lost cause of the war. It's the lost cause of reconciliation. There are people that are against reconciliation, of healing the wounds of the war and basically ripping them back open. And that's the amazing thing to me. Now, one person I did see on social media that actually admitted this. Look, since the 1960s, we've been engaged in finishing Reconstruction. This is what Eric Foner said. It's an unfinished revolution. Well, we're finishing it essentially by eradicating any part of Southern history that doesn't agree with the idea of Reconstruction. So we're going to finish this out. Now, of course, they don't talk about the economic costs of Reconstruction or the political costs of Reconstruction. What they're looking at there is the social Reconstruction, because that's all people think Reconstruction was. Whereas other historians like Philip Lee and his recent book, Southern Reconstruction, or you go back to the turn of the century and people like Dunning, who said, no, Reconstruction was bigger than that. It wasn't just social Reconstruction. It was political Reconstruction. It was the ascendancy of the Republican Party. It was the ascendancy of a Northern-dominated union, North over South. It wasn't just that either. It was economic Reconstruction. The creation of an economy in the United States that was dominated exclusively by the North. And I live in a southern city that for years was a hub of the cotton market, textiles and other things, and now it's banking and finance and insurance. When it's more important to look at the stock market than the cotton market in the South, the entire economy has changed. And people, of course, you can look at that and say, well, that's good. You know, we've got industrialization. We've got more and more middle class people. The South was not poor before the war. Just because you're agricultural doesn't mean you're going to be poor. That's a whole nother debate in and of itself. But certainly, the war impoverished the South. There's no doubt about that. And when you look at, of course, Lee does a very good job of this, looking at the impoverishment of the South, how poor the South was after the war, and it was not poor before the war, contrary to what people might say, it was not poor. And we ran a piece by the late Bill Cawthon on that particular topic several months ago. But the South was not poor before the war, and so the impoverishment of the South was certainly a byproduct of the war and then Reconstruction. And some would say, well, the South deserved that. If that's the only thing they got out of it, then that was it. We didn't hang any of their leaders. If it's just poverty, Just poverty. That's it. Just poverty. I mean, what's that? That's okay. They got off easy because of that. Is that easy? Is being set back economically for nearly a century easy? Because that's essentially what happened. And of course, we've talked about the New South and how you have people like the Callaway family in LaGrange, Georgia, building cotton mills because the idea was to try to bring the South out of poverty, which was hard. And so let's talk about that idea of poverty. This is the piece on Wednesday written by Ronnie Kennedy. And he talks about that. The title of the piece is White Privilege or Yankee Privilege. And so this goes into political correctness, and you look at Confederate monuments and say, well, that's a symbol of white supremacy or white privilege or whatever you want to say. There it is. We got to get rid of these things. But his question is this really what we're talking about? Because white Southerners had no privilege after the war. They were impoverished by the North, terribly impoverished by the North. Southerners didn't live on K Street or Wall Street. Most Southerners were not involved in the highest economic rungs of American society, particularly after the war. And so most Southerners, white and black, were impoverished by the war, terribly impoverished by the war. And I'm going to talk about that poverty in the last two pieces, too, even though they deal a little military history. But certainly this is the case. And he talks about how history is tied into this and how, you know, the narrative of the South fought for only slavery serves as a cover for what the North was trying to do to the South to reconstruct. If you can make people believe that, then the South deserves to be punished. It's the treasury of counterfeit virtue. If you can believe the South deserved the punishment, then nothing that you do to them matters. You can take away their monuments. You can take away their symbols. You can say, you lost, get over it. We're going to take down your stuff. Your ancestors were un-American. In fact, there is a book that I've reviewed for my own podcast, which will be probably next week, but it's entitled From Oligarchy to Republicanism, written by a professor of political science in Alaska named Forrest Neighbors. And Neighbors says that there is only one group of Americans fighting in that war, and those were the Northerners. The Southerners were not Americans. They weren't Americans at all. So now you're looking at one side. This is the new trend in historical literature. It's to resurrect the slave power thesis. It's slave power literature. But not just that. They're calling Southerners un-American. That's probably the mildest attack that's made on them. You have movies now. They're in one particular case, Southerners are not even human. They're vampires, right? They're subhuman. They're these creatures. They're monsters. That's Abraham Lincoln vampire slayers. But they're monsters. Southerners are monsters. They're un-American. These are important things to understand. And people get tired of hearing it. They've been punished by poverty. So the Kennedys actually wrote a little book for Shotwell Press entitled Punished by Poverty. And of course, Lee's Southern Reconstruction, which is so good. It's been the best book on Reconstruction written, I would say, and in a very long period of time, really since maybe the last 50 years on Reconstruction. So you have Southerners who did not receive the privilege they supposedly received because they were impoverished by the war. There was political Reconstruction, economic Reconstruction, and the South, certainly economically, lagged way behind. The Kennedys bring up sharecropping, which affected more white Southerners than black Southerners. This was a terrible system that was hard to get out of once you're in it. There was actually a Ron Rash, who's a North Carolina author, and he he's received critical acclaim. But he wrote a book several years ago, about a decade ago, entitled One Foot in Eden. And it gets into this, it takes place in northern, upcountry South Carolina. And it's Reconstruction era book. Early 20th century, early to mid 20th century. And he talks about how, you know, the coming of the TVA and bringing electrical power to the South and all the sharecropping and other things going on. It's a very interesting story. He focuses a lot on this Gilded Age period in the South, this New South period in a lot of his novels. Selena, I think, was the name of another one, which was made into a movie. People, you know, said the movie was awful. But the fact is, it's this, you know, post-war South that's really a forgotten part of Southern history, because so much of it is just overlooked when you get to the Gilded Age. And the South is still recovering in that time. The New South was a period of economic recovery as Southerners were trying to deal with this terrible repercussions of the war. Social, physical, economic destruction that took place because of the war. That's the part of statues that people need, these monuments that people need to understand. This was a healing for Southerners. A healing period. As they were wrestling with the fact that 75% of white Southerners did fight in the war, and a large percentage of those people were killed or wounded. And when you say wounded, and we were talking about people that lost limbs, could not even farm, couldn't do anything. They were so impoverished that people that had tremendous amounts of wealth before the war were selling eggs just to try to make it after the war, as the piece on Friday talked about. So this idea of poverty, you know, what happened in the South, this is often overlooked. White Southerners still are the most impoverished group of, if you just look at race, of white people in the country. In fact, the majority of people on welfare and food stamps are white, and they live in places like Appalachia, which is very, very poor. So you don't get the full picture of poverty when you look at just quote unquote white privilege. It's uneven, to say the least. And I think the Kennedys do a nice job of showing that. Now, the piece on Thursday was an old piece that was published in the late 19th century in the Confederate Veteran magazine, but it's a college boy's observation of General Lee, and it's written by John Collier, who attended Washington College when Lee was president there, now Washington Lee University. And this is a wonderful little piece because it gets into Lee the character, Lee the man. And of course, Lee's birthday is the 19th, so we ran it the day before his birthday. And it's such a wonderful little piece. It's only three paragraphs. I'm going to read some of this because I think it's so good. And then we'll talk about the last two pieces, the piece on Friday, and then the piece which is a little different on, and this gets into education, the piece the book review did, education. So there's two components of this. One is to talk about this in terms of Lee the man and the politically correct attack on Lee the man, but also to look at Lee as the educator. And so the advice that Lee gave to college students. He says, when he first met Lee, General Lee was alone, looking over a paper. He arose and we entered, and received us with a quiet, gentlemanly dignity that was so natural and easy and kind that the feeling of awe left me at the threshold of his door. General Lee had but one manner in his intercourse with men. It was the same to the peasant as to the prince, and the student was received with the easy courtliness that would have been bestowed on the greatest imperial dignity of Europe. When we had registered my brother and asked the general for a copy of his rules, General Lee said to him, "Young gentlemen, we have no printed rules. We have but one rule here, and it is that every student must be a gentleman." It's a great quote. Every student must be a gentleman. Collier goes on. He says, "I did not until after years fully realize the comprehensiveness of his remark and how completely it covered every essential rule that should govern the conduct and intercourse of men. If men were just gentlemanly, a lot of our problems would disappear in America." He says, "I do not know that I could define the impression that General Lee left on my mind that morning, for I was so disappointed at not seeing the warrior that my imagination had pictured, that my mind was left in a confused state of inquiry as to whether he was the man whose fame had filled the world. He was so gentle, kind, and almost motherly in his bearing that I thought there must be some mistake about it. At first glance, General Lee's countenance was stern, but the moment his eye met that of his entering guest, it beamed with a kindness that at once established easy and friendly relations, but not familiar. The impression he made on me was that he was never familiar with any man." This is not the image you get of Lee, of the vicious racist, but of the kindly Lee, the post-war Lee. This is the man that Americans had known for generations. For generations after he died. He continues, I saw General Lee every day during that session in chapel, for he never missed a morning service, and passing through the campus to and from his home to his office. He rarely spoke to anyone, occasionally would say something to one of the boys as he passed, but never more than a word. After the first morning in his office, he never spoke to me but once. He stopped me one morning as I was passing his front gate and asked how I was getting on with my students. I replied to his inquiry and that was the end of the conversation. He seemed to avoid contact with men, and the impression which he made on me, seeing him every day, and which has since clung to me, strengthening the impression that made, was that he bowed down with a broken heart. With a broken heart. This is Reconstruction. I never saw a sadder expression than General Lee carried during the entire time I was there. It looked as if the sorrow of a whole nation had been collected in his countenance, and as if he was bearing the grief of his whole people. It never left his face, but was ever there to keep company with the kindly smile. This is why statues were built to Robert E. Lee. That one phrase. This is why statues were built of Robert E. Lee. He impressed me as being the most modest man I ever saw in his contact with men. History records how modestly he wore his honors, but I refer to the characteristic in another sense. I dare say no man ever offered to relate a story of questionable delicacy in his presence. His very bearing and presence produced an atmosphere of purity that would have repelled the attempt. As for anything like publicity, notoriety, or display, it was absolutely painful to him. Colonel Ruff, the old gentleman with whom I boarded, told me an anecdote about him that I think worth preserving. General Lee brought with him to Lexington the old iron-gray horse that he rode during the war. A few days after he had been there, he rode up Main Street on his old war horse, and as he passed up the street, the citizens cheered him. After passing the ordeal, he hurried back to his home near the college. He was incapable of affection. The demonstration was simply offensive to his innate modesty, and doubtless awakened the memories of the past that seemed to weigh continually on his heart. The old iron-gray horse was the privileged character at General Lee's home. He was permitted to remain in the front yard where the grass was greenest and freshest, notwithstanding the flowers and shrubbery. General Lee was more demonstrative toward the old companion in battle than seemed to be in his nature in his intercourse with men. I have often seen him, as he would enter his front gate, leave the walk, approach the old gray horse, and caress him for a minute or two before entering his front door, as though they bore a common grief in their memory of the past. I think that's a perfect encapsulation of General Lee and why it's important to leave his statues up. And of course, again, for generations, men North and South recognized the greatness of Lee, and one of the greatest of all American heroes is Chesty Puller. If you go into the Marine Corps, you're going to revere Chesty Puller. And of course, Chesty Puller revered Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. And this little piece by Michael Martin, we published on Friday, is so good because it brings out that. He talks about half the piece, dedicates about half the piece to Puller and his reverence for the South, for Virginia, for his boyhood home, for place, for where he called his ancestral stomping grounds, and how that impacted his life in the Marine Corps, his life as a leader of men. And the picture we put on there is Puller standing in front of a Confederate battle flag. It's actually drawn from a 1970 documentary on Puller, narrated by John Wayne. And John Wayne saying, you know, look, he had no problem with Puller being a man who revered Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. You couldn't do that now. You couldn't get away with that today. But it was Puller's recognition of the Southern military tradition and how he remembers seeing Robert E. Lee Jr. as a boy coming to his home to deliver fruits and vegetables and eggs because he was so impoverished that's all he could do. It's amazing. And this is the South punished by poverty. But of course, Lee's advice to boys, to college students, to be a gentleman. And then the piece we published on Tuesday was a book review of a book by Gene Kizer. The title is A Useful and Pro-Southern Book for Today's College Student, College or University Student, written by Michael Potts. But the point of this is to learn how to be a good student. And so part of that is academic. And this is gets into the academic part of the book, of being a good student. I think students need to get that. And so if you have a college-age student, maybe getting Kizer's book would be a good idea. But also it's to be a gentleman. One of the things that college students don't do oftentimes is engage themselves in gentlemanly conduct. And if we use gentlemanly conduct to govern our affairs with other people and how we interacted with people, particularly people you don't know, male and female, a lot of the problems we have in America would not be there. I mean, it's just a fact. You know, the things that are going on with harassment and issues like that, that's all just a lack of gentlemanly behavior. That's what it comes down to. And so Lee's charge to be a gentleman and Kizer's understanding of how to be a good student, if you put those two things together, you would have a well-educated Southern student. And by well-educated Southern student, also in terms of conduct, because that's important, how we conduct ourselves and how we engage people in this debate over monuments and other things. It is important. And how we conduct ourselves in our daily lives. This is not, the South. It's important to note to show that the South is not what you get on reality television. That real Southerners are not that way. Real Southerners engage themselves and with others in a gentlemanly or ladylike conduct. That's important to do. And so I think that Lee's lasting impression should be that. And of course, understanding where we come from and these monuments and why they were there is important as well. And so if we can get that. If we can somehow get that across, and that's what we do at the Institute, to try to get that across to people. We're the last remnant trying to push this, saying this is what, you know, this is what's important, this is what's valuable in the Southern tradition, this is what we're trying to do. Perhaps the entire United States would be a better place to live. Until next time, good day.